Did you go out for your birthday?
I did, yeah. I went to Little Wolf.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, with a whole bunch of family. So that was fun. Sean brought me a bottle of Prosecco. That was pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
And tell me one of the things that you ate.
Well, they have this duck sausage on the menu with lentils.
Okay.
That's like really up my alley. Mm-hmm. Except it's kind of funny looking.
Is it because it's a swirl full sausage?
Coil.
Yeah.
What's that? Yeah, it's a coil of sausage.
Okay.
And
tell me how you feel about that.
I mean, part of me thinks it's hilarious.
Why? Why would that be funny?
Because it looks like a poop emoji.
Oh my God, Shale. Grow up. How... I'm actually really sensitive about it because I used to love making those coils, like especially with like a lamb casing, like a slender little sausage that's just like a perfect little spiral.
Yeah.
And one time at June's, I made lamb sausage and we were serving it with Israeli couscous. And the person who was doing social media for June's wouldn't put it on online because they were like, well, it just looks like poop.
Right.
And I took it pretty personally.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a traditional presentation. I don't know.
Yeah, but it does look like a poop emoji, though.
No, it doesn't, because it's flat. Yeah. It's two-dimensional. Well,
it looks like a spiral. I understand why you're saying that. But you can see the similarity, though. If you say that you can't see the similarity, I feel like you're just making that up to justify your point.
I think that I've never used the poop emoji in my entire life. In my entire life. And okay. I was
not
much
even
more
when you're pooping?
Oh my God.
I'm sorry. Okay. This isn't okay. That's a little too personal.
I will walk away from this just so you know.
Conversation.
There's no
over.
There's nothing forcing me to sit through this.
Sorry.
Anyways, how did the sausage taste?
It's delicious, and the lentils were delicious. And just to clarify things here. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of just playing devil's advocate, which I'm sure you're probably aware of. But the reason why I'm playing devil's advocate is because some other people who were sitting at our table had that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's valid. It's a valid reaction. Now, do I think that you can still serve that dish in that presentation with the understanding that people are going to make that connection and still... you know, and understand that and do it anyway, or do it in a way that like plays into that, or do it in a way that
plays into it.
I mean, you don't really want to play into it.
No.
Reminding people of poop for sure. But, you know, like if you know that that is the reaction that people are going to have, maybe there's something that you can do to satirize the situation or something. I don't really know. But I think it would be naive to think that people aren't going to make that connection because it's, I don't know, it's just visually a very strong connection, I feel like. And I don't think that that means that you shouldn't serve it that way, you know?
I would love to hear the specifics of your idea on how to satirize the shape.
Well, I shouldn't have brought it up because I don't have an idea, but maybe satirize isn't the right word. I guess what I mean is like, you can understand that people are going to make that association, but you know, maybe there's still a way to do it that maybe it's like better to try to find a way to downplay that association or do something in the presentation that's going to downplay that association or, you know, at least make people aware that you're aware of the association or something like that. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what I'm reaching for, but I, you know, like you said, it's a traditional presentation. The way the sausage is, like, the way the sausage is made in this situation is like really cool. And it's really cool to be able to, you know, make a sausage in that traditional style. And the, in that style, like, it's just a great format for the sausage because the casing is like really snappy and it just like, and also you can have a big piece of sausage that you can, you know, bring to the table. It's like the size of a main course, but it's like this cohesive thing that you made. Like, I think it's really cool, but I think it would be naive to think that people won't make that association.
If the sausage were green, would it be different? Like if it were,
I suppose,
like,
it depends on the color of green, Alan.
Oh my God. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sudeby. I'm here with my co-host, Shale McDonald. Hello, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
Do we love to talk about it? Are we still friends?
Moving right along. Shale, I went to Victoria last week. Have you ever been to Victoria? Amazing. Victoria, British Columbia, Canada?
Yeah, I have been, but I haven't been in quite a while, like years and years. I think when I was living in Vancouver and on the Sunshine Coast for like 7 years, I think I maybe went to Victoria once. Mm-hmm. So it's been a long time, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, I love it. I think that if I didn't live in Edmonton, I would want to live in Victoria, I think.
Right on. Yeah, we've got some really good family friends who live in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And my mom has been to visit them recently. I'd love to go. So how was it? What did you do? Did you have any fancy meals?
No fancy meals. Lisa and I and our two kids. And this was the first time. So our youngest, Oliver, was born a few months before the pandemic started. And so this was his first time on a plane, actually.
Oh, wow.
I think only his second time out of province and his first time on a plane, first time on a boat, a lot of firsts.
That's cool. How did he do?
Oh, great. Yeah. I mean,
it was awesome.
The plane ride was thrilling. I mean, it's a short ride. It's an hour and 20 minutes or something from Edmonton. But yeah, he had a lot of fun. Food wise, like, I've been there a few times over the last, say, 10 years. And, Lisa and I had like places we would always go to that, we were not able to do with kids. Like, we needed to make sure that they liked the food and it had to be casual and everything. So some of our regular spots, like Little Jumbo and Fishhook and stuff, we weren't able to go to. So we did lots of really great casual eating, did Redfish, Bluefish, which is a necessity. There's a new place that just opened since the last time that we were there called Serena's Pizza and Hoagies.
Oh, okay.
It was really good. Really, really great pizza. They do like...
Sorry, what's Redfish, Bluefish? Can you back up a little bit?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Redfish, Bluefish is a fish and chip shop right on one of the wharves there. Not Fisherman's Wharf, but... a short ways north of the central harbor there. I think there's a connection. I can't remember the name of the chef who started it. I'm pretty sure he was on Top Chef or Top Chef Canada.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it's an institution now. Like, it's, you know, a lineup down the dock, almost anytime you're there. And yeah, just really solid. They do, fish and chips and they have like, tacones, like cone tacos with like albacore tuna and stuff in them. Yeah, it's really good. And they have like seating built onto the dock, so you look out over the water as you're eating. And yeah, Serena's Pizza was awesome. There's a little, I think they have multiple locations, but there's a little shop there called Burger Crush.
Okay.
That is, it's like smash patty kind of situation. But I really, really like it. The menu is so focused. Like, it might be the most focused menu I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's like,
there's like a cheeseburger and a vegan cheeseburger, and there's French fries, and there's milkshakes and vegan milkshakes. And that's the entire menu.
What about like for toppings? They don't have different burger toppings. You just, there's a cheeseburger and it has, comes with certain toppings, and then that's that.
Yeah. You can like omit them or whatever, but it has the, right, the classics. It's got iceberg and onions, tomatoes, pickles, ketchup or something, or sorry, no, a crushed sauce or something, some kind of aioli kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That is focused.
But yeah, it's just so, it's focused in a way.
Yeah,
that
it is.
That I can't think of another operation that is so limited
yeah,
in totally what they offer. And it's really good though.
Is there a lineup for that place too?
We never had, I ate there twice, certainly never had to wait in line. There was a lot of, okay, like the actual dining room, it only has like 10 seats or something in it. But mm-hmm. they do loads of takeout and online ordering. Like it was a constant flow of, you know, Uber Eats drivers and stuff waiting right. for orders there and stuff. So
it's really interesting. Like, you know, it's sort of like, I don't know, it like pokes a hole in the idea that you have to have something for everybody or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in a way they do, like, because they're very intentional about their vegan offerings. Like you can have a fully mm-hmm. vegan cheeseburger, milkshake, French fry experience.
Right.
But yeah, I was really interested in it, especially like knowing a bit about like Fox Burger and its development. The big trade-off is like they do sell cans of beer at Burger Crush, but I'm interested to know like if you have a bit more of a proper dining room and a bit more of a full menu, like with not just like if burgers are the feature, great, but you also have appetizers, you're able to like sell more liquor. And right. here they're not going to be selling as much alcohol, but the operation is so streamlined. It was a really interesting concept to me. Like one that seems like it could scale well, like, I mean, to multiple locations, and even maybe a franchise kind of situation, but.
Right. Yeah, I like when you were saying that it was focused and before you told me that they have like six items on their menu or, mm-hmm. or whatever, mm-hmm. I was thinking like Flatboy. Like Flatboy is pretty focused.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah.
But yeah, clearly like, I mean, at Burger Crush, can you order a double?
Yes. So, okay. The menu item is, it just says cheeseburger and you can have a single or a double. And gotcha. You can omit some of the toppings and stuff. So it really, I guess you're right. It is this, a similar scope to something like Flatboy.
Yeah. Well, I think Flatboy has like a few, I think they have, don't they have like one or two sort of like specialty burgers though too? Like I think Flatboy is a little bigger menu than that, but.
Actually, I can't remember.
Yeah. I don't exactly remember either. I've only been there twice, I guess. So.
And they're not at the Granite anymore. Did you know that?
I had heard that, but I wasn't sure if they had already moved or what the situation was. So they're at the, how do I say this on the podcast?
Just spell it every time. Spell it.
They are at the Shiddy's Distillery, mm-hmm. Shiddys.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I was driving past there today and I saw their truck pull down that street and I was like, oh, they must have moved already. But right. I wasn't sure if like they're just sort of like in the middle of that move or whether they're open yet or not. But mm-hmm. that's kind of exciting because it's like, I don't know.
It's your work hood.
8 blocks from my work. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the name? So that's on 78th Avenue, like west of 99th. So Ritchie area. But yeah. there's a few like breweries and distilleries that have shops on that street. And I think there's a catchy name for that strip, but I can't remember
what it is. It's called Happy Beer Street.
Happy Beer Street. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a bunch of breweries on that, mm-hmm. in that stretch of 99th Street, and just, yeah, specifically in like on like the west of 99th Street offshoots, like on 78th and 79th probably, or something. Mm-hmm. Or maybe 79th is residential already. I can't remember.
I can't picture.
But yeah. Yeah, it's kind of cool. Like, there's just a collection of like really cool breweries around there. Like, Bent Stick,
I think so. And Ale Architect.
Yeah, and Monolith.
Oh, really? Is that where that is?
Yeah, Monolith is like right across the street from Bent Stick, I believe. Yeah,
it's. I'm happy. Like, it sounds like, Flatboy was like kind of bursting at the seams in a way at the Granite, but
I'm sure they were.
It really was like, I mean, if we did, we've already done a Hidden Gems episode, but if any restaurant could be called a Hidden Gem, it would have been Flatboy at the Granite Curling Club.
Yeah. Like just like so hidden, like almost hard to find in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the really excellent food in a, obscure location. It was like the definition of, but anyways, I'm excited to see their new setup.
Yeah, me too. Hopefully I'll see it this week.
Shale.
Anything else from Victoria? What? Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Okay. You can say Shale again.
You always ask this, but I was going to ask Shale, do you have any follow-up? Any follow-up, Shale?
Oh, actually, Well, I know I have a piece of follow-up, but it's kind of bummer follow-up because I didn't really get any more information. I was going to try to find out exactly where the first location of Earl's was.
Right.
But I did a bunch more digging, and I couldn't really find anything else that any other sources that really gave any additional information. And I was... Man, I was on the verge of going to like the city archives to see if I could dig something up, but it's been a kind of a nutty couple of weeks for me, and I just really didn't have time to do that. Mm-hmm. But that might be the only way to get any additional validation, aside from like hitting up like older friends who lived in Edmonton during that time period and seeing if they just happened to remember. But
as soon as the revenue stream starts, the first thing I want to do with the money from this podcast is to hire a historian who can look up all of our questions about the first Earl's location and the Don the Beachcomber location on Jasper and all of these bits of Edmonton restaurant history.
Edmonton lore. Yeah.
That's how I would spend it.
It's like really I'm not constantly thinking about Edmonton restaurant history. It's not like really. I hate to break it to you, Alan. I'm sorry, it's a deep, dark secret I've been keeping from you. it's not something that's like going through my head all the time. Mm-hmm. But whenever we have one of these conversations or whenever I have a question like this, like, oh, like what was that restaurant that I remember from when I was a kid? Or what's that restaurant that I remember someone talking about someone working at or something?
Right.
It always feels like we have no resource for Edmonton restaurant history. And it's like,
that's right.
It's kind of sad and frustrating. And I don't really feel like I'm the person to do that, but if I had the means, I would want to try to find someone and fund them to try and make something like that, you know.
And it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, Shale, as like at least when the formal like food criticism was happening in newspapers, at least that is archived, but now that it's like, you know, I'm sorry. Now that it's stupid, like 10-second TikTok reviews, like that's all just going to disappear. Like 10 years from now, you will not be able to access any of it. And it wouldn't be meaningful anyways, but like,
No, it's totally ephemeral now. I mean, even with the Internet Archive and things like that, it's just like, especially stuff that's like locally focused is just like totally ephemeral. Mm-hmm. It's kind of rough.
Yeah, I think it's a shame.
The other one piece of follow-up that I did have is that Hollandaise powder is all over the grocery store. I didn't really realize that. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, yeah, they probably sell it in the grocery store. But, yeah, a quick look at the grocery store inventory online. There's like 10 brands or something. It's
right.
Kind of funny.
Why is that funny?
Well, just that I didn't know that mm-hmm. I probably walk by it like 200 times a year or something and
right.
just never notice it. It's just outside of the scope of what I can notice at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Do you have any follow up, Alan?
Nope.
How about this? Oh man. I just thought of a topic for us, but I'm going to ask you a question anyways, and you can let me know what you're thinking about it.
Okay.
How do you feel about the Loblaws boycott?
I don't know very much about it.
Okay.
Is it because they think they're price gouging?
Yeah. I haven't read a ton about it. I've just been seeing it. I've been seeing things about it pop up on social media. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that there's a boycott right now of Loblaws grocery stores, which includes Superstore.
Loblaws,
like City Markets. And I think they own another big grocery chain, don't they?
Well, Wholesale Club.
Oh, really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't call that a big grocery chain, but yeah, that makes sense. Since they carry their products.
Mm. And No Frills, I think, right? Or
maybe. Yeah, anyway, so people are people have asserted that Loblaws is price gouging, that groceries cost more than they should. There's been a federal push to get grocery stores to sign on to this code of conduct, which I don't really know a whole lot about either. Like, I don't know really the specifics of it. Mm-hmm. But Loblaws was like really hesitant to sign on, as were a bunch of other grocery purveyors. Like, I heard that Walmart said that they're not going to sign that. And I think Costco said that they're also not going to, or I'm not exactly sure what's going on with it, but... Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyway, right now there's a boycott of Loblaws, like a grassroots kind of, let's hit them where it hurts and fight with our purchasing power as consumers, kind of grassroots boycott. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really interesting to me because, you know, Loblaws, I guess like, you know, at the simplest level, for what I've been able to glean just from like seeing stuff on social media, it's that Loblaws has been very profitable in the last few years.
Right. Yeah.
But the price of groceries continues to rise. And so, you know, like what's more important, their profitability or the affordability of groceries, I guess, is what people have a problem with. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's interesting that right now a whole bunch of Canadians are boycotting a grocery store. Mm-hmm. And somewhat food related.
Oh, right. Now I understand.
Sorry if you were having trouble figuring out why I was bringing it up on the podcast. It's because I thought it was somewhat food related.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know, like, you're right. I think I can even remember at least a few times over the last couple years where CBC has specifically reported on the profitability of Loblaws, like what their fourth quarter blah 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 was.
Right.
It's interesting. Like, I don't really know why Loblaws is singled out. The rise in prices has been crazy. Like, it's, And so I'm curious, I don't know, like, so if for those who are boycotting Loblaws, where are they going instead? And are the prices really that? Cause, I mean, so many of these places do price matching. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can walk into some, I don't know about Superstore actually, but like some Loblaws businesses, like for instance, Real mm-hmm. Canadian Liquor Store, they price match. And so if you bring in an ad for, the same product from a different vendor at a lower price, they'll match it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm curious to know, like, is Loblaws really the
bad guy here?
Are they being egregious when compared to others? And I actually don't know. Like, we do a lot of our grocery shopping at Superstore and at No Frills. But yeah, there are certain things, like, for instance, we've noticed, you know, H&W, obviously.
Mm-hmm. It's a produce vendor in Edmonton.
Yeah. And our kids eat like 20 pounds of fresh fruit a week, at least.
Why?
Between apples and berries. I don't know. They're crazy for it. Like, it's insane. Like, I never would have eaten that way when I was their age, but, they love it.
That's great.
And, one thing that we've noticed is that not only does H&W have far better prices on, say, fresh berries, they also seem to be, I wouldn't say a higher quality, but like oftentimes we find ourselves buying stuff from Superstore and then we get it home and either that afternoon or the next day, like, oh, actually, like, half of this is rotten kind of thing. Yeah. And
I've had that experience too.
And I don't know if it's like, yeah, I don't know how they're able to do it, but H&W, like the longevity of the fruits that we buy from them, is markedly different than Superstore. Like, we can, because they'll have deals on the weekends where it's like you can buy a flat of strawberries, basically for the cost that it would, or sorry, for the price that it would be for 2 pounds at Superstore, and it lasts for the whole week, and there's no quality issues. So, but yeah, I mean, outside of specific things like that, really, Superstore is like, that's where we're buying
your go-to grocery store. Yeah, it has been for me too. And I don't know, it's interesting because I don't want to get all philosophical, but I think the reason why so many people go to Superstore is because when it started out, it was like a really inexpensive place to shop.
Yeah.
Like, they had the best prices.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When they first started, like, however long ago, 30 years ago or whatever, or more probably. And then I think, because of that, they were very successful. They were able to, you know, build a lot of stores, a lot of like really large scale grocery stores. That was sort of like the other differentiating factor for them. Mm-hmm. They're just such huge stores. So they have such a huge selection of products that, that you can, you know, basically get everything that you would want. And so now people are just in the habit of mostly going to Superstore, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they've been in a situation where they can raise the prices and that doesn't harm their differentiation anymore, you know, because people are just in the habit of going there. You know, and I think that that's been really good for them. But I don't know, like, it's weird because some of the other things that are going on around this boycott are like, there was some stuff that happened during the pandemic when supply was, really tough on some items. Mm-hmm. They weren't able to keep stock on the shelves of a lot of items because of supply chain issues and supply constraints and things like that.
You're talking about toilet paper, and right?
that's the one that everybody knows about. But there were lots of other ones too.
Yeah.
And during that, in order to try to satisfy their customer demand, Loblaws was fining their suppliers if they weren't able to deliver certain amount of, say, toilet paper or Kraft dinner or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. If the supplier wasn't able to provide what they had normally been able to provide, then Loblaws was fining the supplier. And so,
that seems illegal.
I don't think it's illegal if you have a contract with a specific supplier for them to provide you with a certain amount of product every month or something like that. Like, you know, for instance, I know at Kind Ice Cream, like, we have deals set up with our suppliers to say that, you know, we are going to need them to supply us with a certain amount of, say, cream or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've ever really been in a situation where we would need to like try to make a lawsuit against someone because they weren't supplying us with, you know, like usually if we get into a supply issue, we'll just try to procure from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. It's not really the amount of money that it would wind up costing us. It would have to really harm our business in order for it to be worthwhile for us to go after anyone legally. But for Loblaws, you know, talking about a lot more money. And so I'm sure that they do have contracts with these suppliers that say that they're supposed to be able to get a certain amount of product. And so they probably can go after them legally. But from what I understand, that has harmed the overall price, you know, for the consumer, because it's become more expensive because for the producers that are selling their goods to Loblaws, because in addition to selling them the goods or whatever, they are also having to pay Loblaws for these lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And so it's made it more expensive on the back end for Loblaws to purchase these products, because the price has been going up from the suppliers because they also have to pay these like lawsuits. And so they're saying now that the reason why the prices are more expensive for consumers is because the prices have been going up from the suppliers. And I'm sure that that's true, but it sort of seems like this weird vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. And it sort of seems like maybe Loblaws was a part of the problem there. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say 15 years ago, I was really trying to like save a lot of money and chisel down my expenses. And I did actually, I took our standard kind of weekly grocery list and I went to four or five different grocery stores, close to me. And Superstore was consistently the lowest price for most of the stuff that we bought. And right. so that was lodged in my mind. And that was like, that was a kind of turning point for me where I was like, well, like if I can save whatever it was, we didn't have kids yet, but I was like, if I can save $20 or $30 a week by shopping there, even though I, at the time, like I hated going there. Cause it, like you said, it was such a large place and it was so busy. And yeah. It just felt,
it's usually out of the way too. Like
yeah,
it's outside your neighborhood because it's on the outskirts of the city usually because they need a big box store.
So I guess I need to do that again, basically, now that, you know, 15 years on and my weekly grocery bill is way bigger now,
than it was back then. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's, I think really that's the tough thing, you know, like, that's it's a big ask to ask consumers to do that, you know, to like do that math every time they go to a grocery store. And so when you find a place that feels significantly cheaper and you can demonstrably show that shopping there, your grocery bills are less, then, you know, you make the decision, well, I'm just going to start going here now.
Right. Yeah.
And then but then like once you've made that decision, you know, like I feel like a lot of people are like don't really want to have to go through doing that shopping around and doing that math again, you know? It's like that decision's made, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I haven't bought any groceries really. I bought a few things from TNT since the boycott has been happening, but I haven't had to like actually buy my weekly groceries yet. And so I'm kind of like, maybe I'll just go somewhere else.
So you're in on it. You're boycotting it.
I might as well. I don't know.
I mean, everyone else is doing it.
If it results in lower grocery prices, then I don't see what the harm is.
Next thing you're going to tell me that you're cheering for the Edmonton Oilers.
I mean, they're the only Canadian team left in the... Just kidding, Alan. You know I don't care about hockey. Although it's kind of fun to watch sometimes.
Yeah, to watch, to play. Yeah.
I've never played it. I mean, floor hockey. I played floor hockey.
Floor hockey. What about street hockey?
Not really.
Do you know how to skate show?
Not very well.
Oh.
I had a... We are never getting to the topic.
There's a topic? Oh, wait, are you recording this?
I should have told you. Yeah. I kind of had a bad skating accident when I was in grade 3.
Really?
And it was a little bit traumatic for me, and I didn't skate for a while after that. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of like, I skated a lot when I was like really young. Me and my mom and dad and my little brother would like go to the rink and just skate around and stuff. We all had skates, and it was like a fun wintertime activity that we used to do. But yeah, I had kind of a traumatic, fell on my face and kind of broke a couple teeth and got pretty scared of skating when I was in grade 3. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't skate for a while. And then by the time I kind of tried to pick it back up again, A, I was a little bit tentative, and B, I was like behind where everybody else was.
Right.
And so I didn't want to do it because I was bad at it, and also I was a little bit scared. So I'm not great at skating. But I don't really think I'm afraid of it anymore like I was.
Right.
Why, you want to go?
I'll take you, sure.
Okay, cool.
Put it in the calendar.
Yeah.
For December.
Hopefully. I feel like last December there wouldn't have been ice yet, but
that's true, actually, yeah.
Sorry.
Welcome to food court.
Yeah, so we do have a topic. It's kind of, it sort of like came up in our last podcast, in our last episode. I think maybe you brought it up when we talked about it, when I presented it to you as a possible topic earlier today. It seemed like you thought that I had masterminded it, but I kind of thought when we were talking in the last episode, you sort of like brought it up, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
What did I say?
I don't exactly remember what you said, but we were talking about how Eggs Benedict is like on every brunch menu.
Right.
And then I think you said something along the lines of like, that's a topic. Like maybe I said like, why are there foods like that just have to be on a menu? Otherwise it's like just, you know, people will revolt or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think you were like, oh, that's a topic. So
okay.
I wrote it down as a topic.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the topic. You know, why are there foods that just like are just so common on menus that people expect them? And if they aren't there, you know, people constantly ask for them.
Right.
To the extent that it almost feels like you have to provide them. Otherwise, people will not be satisfied coming to your restaurant or whatever.
Can I tell you the first thing that comes to mind when you put it that way is in a evening fine dining setting.
Yeah, like casual fine dining.
For many years, I thought and was told that you needed to have a green salad as one of your appetizers. Okay. And actually, we've kind of, I don't know if you remember, we've actually talked about this before, but I have this menu from Hardware Grill, like the actual...
Right. I mean, we've gone through that whole menu, I think.
Yeah, through most of it, yeah. To the point that there's like this joke on this menu under the soup and salad section. One of the menu items is, sure, we have a green salad, $12.
Right. Whoa, $12.
Well,
that's
hard.
An old menu.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that was something like the dynamic there was that, you know, hardcore chefs and line cooks weren't interested in making tossed green salads because they thought they were boring and insipid. But a lot of people, I mean, it's a nice way to start a meal sometimes. And so this was something when I started in evening dining at Nate, I was somewhat resolved to not have a tossed green salad on the menu and got some comments and not pushback exactly, but like some comments about it. But we always had,
this is such a common, the reason why this is a topic is because what you're talking about right now is such a common chef experience that like, I feel like everyone who's ever, you know, tried to design a menu for a restaurant has been in the situation that you're describing right now. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but yeah.
So for the first while, like we would always have a salad or like, some kind of cold vegetable forward, like it would be a beet salad or something like that. But we would always like, we'd keep greens on hand just in case someone asked for a green salad. And I think it happened twice in the first year where someone was like, well, do you have lettuce in the kitchen? Can I have a, can I have green salad? But then after that, the last 2.5 years that I was in evening dining, not a single request for a green salad. And I think, so I don't know, like, as long as the menu is still balanced and you have something that's kind of like fulfilling that same desire, like something, whatever that is, like it could be, yeah, like a cold vegetable focused appetizer or, or whatever. It really was not an issue at all. That's the first thing that comes to my mind in terms of like, oh, you absolutely need to have this. I think that maybe, so if that example is like, well, maybe you don't actually need to have it as long as you're kind of putting something there that fills the same need. I think there's other situations where people are or could be genuinely disappointed or surprised by not having a certain offering. Like, you know, like if you have, if you have hamburgers on the menu, but you don't have French fries, like that's kind of a bummer for me. I can't think of a place that's done that, but that would be an example.
Yeah, that would be super weird. And every person who ordered a burger would be like, oh, you don't have fries? Oh, okay. And then it wouldn't matter what you had in place of fries. Right. Like,
it's like potato chips. It's fried potatoes. What's the difference?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We have baked potatoes, potato chips, mashed potatoes. We have Pompana. We have, you know, like, we have croquettes.
Like,
you could have like 30 different kinds of potatoes, but if you didn't have fries, you'd have people who were like, what the hell?
There was an element of that actually at Zalt's, like where we were serving like sausages was the focus, like bratwurst and stuff. And it's not like people like would walk out when they heard that we didn't have a deep fryer and French fries, but it was just such an obvious, like, you know, it would be great if this, currywurst had French fries with it. and yeah, that's actually something that's French fries is actually maybe a pretty important, element here. That's another thing. I loved Three Boars, like loved it, went many times, had so many memorable meals there. The fact that, oh, and actually Little Wolf is kind of carrying on in this tradition because they're in the same kitchen with the same equipment. But the fact that the poutine at Three Boars and now at Little Wolf is not made with French fries kind of annoys me.
It's like little roast potatoes.
Like little kind of baby gems and stuff. And whatever, that's fine. Like it still tastes great, but if you say poutine
and it's not French
fries, and I'm
not
eating French fries, part of me, I might not say it out loud, but part of me is disappointed.
And well, this is kind of the thing for me that is sort of the nugget of this topic is that like if you don't really have the means to produce it, then why have poutine on the menu? Right. And what is it serving? Is it serving a customer expectation? Is it, you know, like, do you need to have something on the menu with potatoes for food cost reasons? Like, you know, why then make the decision to have poutine on the menu if you have no way to make French fries? Right. Like, that's sort of the nugget of the conversation to me, you know, like, what is it that's driving the choices to have things on menus that may not necessarily be original, be within the, you know, production means of the restaurant? You know, why is it so important to put things on the menu that, you know, will go out of our way to, alter a dish beyond recognition to make sure that we can put those words on the menu or something? Just seems seems really weird and interesting.
But the words are what sells the food, right? Like you,
right.
Poutine, like you know, it's awesome. It sounds awesome when you read it on the menu. And I'm sure lots of people are happy to eat a variation of poutine with roasted baby potatoes instead of French fries. But
yeah.
Yeah. That's another kind of big piece of the conversation is just that what people order is based on the words on the menu, not on, in North America anyways, not usually based on photographs of the food or having been able to sample it. So,
right. That's a big disclaimer that we should make here, is that really this doesn't apply to like any regional restaurant or any restaurant that's like representing a regional cuisine. I guess like you could maybe apply it to like Western Chinese food restaurants. There's like some things there that are just standards where people would freak out if they weren't on the menu or something like that.
Right.
But again, that's more like North American food, or, you know, it's Westernized Chinese food or something like that. So it's still, I think, Western food.
So what are, do you have any other examples of, a lot of this is kind of, it's about genre, kind of like it's about, like a certain style of food or service, where you go in with an expectation about what will be offered.
So I did a little bit of sort of like, what would we call it? Show prep? Sure. Let's call it show prep.
Mise en place? Okay. Just kidding.
yeah, exactly. I did a little bit of mise en place before the show here, and I picked out a few types of restaurants that I think are particularly kind of... subject to this, or a few kinds of menus that are particularly subject to these, this sort of influence. So this is by no means an exhaustive list, but these are just sort of like the ones that stood out to me sort of off the top of my head that are kind of the types of menus or the types of restaurants where, you know, this, I feel like what we're talking about is kind of the most applicable. So number one, like with a bullet, I think, is brunch.
Right.
Brunch menus are like, I mean, they tend to have a differentiating factor, you know, like lots of restaurants have brunch, and there are lots of different types of restaurants that sort of have like different food thematically. And so there will usually be something on the brunch menu that represents the like thematic nature of the food of that restaurant when it's not serving brunch.
Right.
But like basically every brunch menu has like so many standards.
Right.
So brunch, casual fine dining, like North American fine dining, but you know, not necessarily tablecloths. Is a big one.
What would be an example of a required dish
on a casual fine dining menu? Alan, there's so many good ones, and I want to get through my list first, but the very first one I have on my list is carpaccio.
Okay. Well, right? I mean, yeah.
Like, I mean, you can argue any of them for sure. Like anything that's on this list, you can argue it, but like how many casual fine dining restaurants have a carpaccio? Like it's so many.
Lots,
it's like,
but I think it's different. Okay. So if I went out for brunch and they didn't have Eggs Benedict, I would be upset. Well, not upset, but like I would be confused or whatever. But if I went to a casual fine dining restaurant and they didn't have carpaccio, there's no way that I would be like, feel like I'm entitled to have carpaccio just because I'm going.
No. I hear you. And that's why brunch is number one with a bullet.
Yeah.
You know, because casual fine dining restaurants tend to have a wider variation of things. You expect some creativity on the menu. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I would say that, you know, a large percentage of that type of restaurant has something on the menu that's like a carpaccio. Mm-hmm. And I think people do expect it to some extent. And then this one's like just real easy, but it's kind of, I don't know. You tell me. This one I'm definitely like willing to be argued down on. But I think pub menus are like this as well.
Right. Fish and chips, burgers. And then, is that
yeah.
it? Anything
yeah,
else on
exactly.
that?
Exactly. But the reason why I don't feel maybe as strongly about it is because I feel like for a pub menu, there's more of a contextual, I don't know, this is weird, but like there's more of a contextual reason for why they're serving the food that they're serving, you know?
Okay.
Like in a way, because it's meant to be like either shared or finger foods or something, because you're drinking and eating at the same time or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's maybe not the pub's fault,
right?
That like all pub menus are the same or something, or it is the pub's fault that all pub menus are the same, but that makes it a more reasonable similarity. I don't know. Mm. Seems maybe a little bit more reasonable in my mind. And then the last thing that I have on the list, well, and I do have another one in mind, but I didn't actually write anything down about it. So, we'll get to it after. The last thing isn't really a style of restaurant. It's dessert menus,
right?
Dessert menus are just like haunted by this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then I would say, like, you know, the other thing is like quote unquote chain restaurants. I know that there are a lot of chain restaurants that sort of have differentiation, you know, like there's chain restaurants that are supposed to be more like, you know, Southern barbecue, or there's right. Outback Steakhouse, which is supposed to be like an Australian steakhouse.
Australian, yeah.
You know, right? Yeah, authentic Australian. You know, yeah. But I think like North American chains, you know, like also have a lot of this going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
you need to have your spinach dip. You need to have your nachos. You need to have.
You need to have some kind of like pizza. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, those are sort of like the key categories that I kind of came up with off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a list for each of these. So we can go through the list if you want, or
yeah, we should.
Maybe it's more fun for you to try and come up with things and see if they're on my list, or I don't know.
Well, I was interested that, like you said, you said that restaurants who are focusing on like a regional or ethnic cuisine kind of aren't part of this conversation because they have their standards that they're meant to provide. I think that actually is also, that's actually one that drives me crazy, is that you have something like,
right.
And I think I've probably talked about this before, but like Greek food, where every restaurant, every Greek restaurant in Canada has almost the exact same menu.
Yeah.
And first of all, that's very much, most of those items really are from like Southern Greece, where tourists go. It's from like Athens and Attica and the Cyclades Islands and like that, the Aegean, basically, like the big tourist spots. And that's kind of to be expected.
I think the same thing could be like, said for American Italian.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Like, well, it's like very much like Southern Italy, like, yeah, Sicily, Calabria, like, yeah, red sauce, fennel, garlic, chili, pork, olive oil.
Risotto, what's that?
Well, honestly, it wasn't, we're kind of retreading stuff, but like, it wasn't until Mercado in Calgary and then Corso 32 in Edmonton that like really opened my eyes to the full spectrum of Italian regional.
But it
makes sense, like if you're, most of the people who are eating at Greek restaurants in Edmonton aren't from Greece, but they maybe have traveled there, or they understand a little bit about the tourist culture there. Maybe it makes sense to offer that.
That's kind of why I'm giving them a little bit of leeway. You know, like izakayas that you see in Edmonton, they tend to have the same range of dishes. You know, they have some udon and some takoyaki, and they have some, you know, pressed sushi, and, you know, like it's sort of, and it's because you have to educate people,
mm-hmm.
right? Like,
Oh yeah.
You know? And so I kind of feel like those types of regional cuisines, I don't really fault them for this because they're sort of in a hostile environment. I don't know. Like,
right. I wouldn't have put it that way, but I know what you mean. Like they have to do a lot more work for people to understand the food than like a diner does for most of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But it is interesting, like maybe this isn't the best example, but say like the phyllo pies at Greek restaurants, like obviously mm-hmm. spanakopita, like that's on every single Greek restaurant menu in North America. And that undoubtedly is the king of phyllo pies in Greece, but like there's hundreds of other stuff that they put in phyllo in Greece.
Phyllo.
Like you can like mashed potatoes and roasted peppers and walnuts.
It's a style of food
like
there.
Exactly.
Instead of just a dish. Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
I don't know, if I went to a Greek restaurant and they didn't have spanakopita, maybe I'd be disappointed. But be pretty best. But if they had, you know, phyllo with lemon mashed potatoes in it, lemon garlic mashed potatoes in it, I think I would enjoy that.
Be too. Happy.
Yeah. So yeah. You're right. It is a bit of a different situation when they're, yeah, there's some customer education going on, and like you don't want to have to start at the beginning with every single customer that walks in the door and say, okay.
Right. Whereas every North American knows what a green salad is. So right. It's, you know, like, yeah.
Okay. So are we going back to brunch or what are we doing?
Okay, sure. Yeah. Let's start with brunch then.
Okay. So there has to be...
Do you want to guess? Yeah.
Well, here are the things that need to be on a brunch menu. First of all, there needs to be the two eggs any style menu. You know what I mean? Or sorry, the two eggs any mm-hmm. style menu item. So it's like where the diner gets to pick and choose. First of all, they pick the way that their eggs are cooked. They pick whether they're having sausage or bacon or both. And they get toasted.
White or brown toast.
And, yeah, they pick their bread for the toast and they get hash browns. That needs to be there. There needs to be eggs Benedict. Usually, like, I don't think that people necessarily require this, but it's just funny that there's always like an annoying amount of variations on Benedict. So it'll be like eggs Benedict Florentine, eggs Benedict Calabrese, eggs Benedict.
Yeah, you kind of need to have like a salmon Benny and a ham Benny or like a bacon Benny, some kind of pork Benny.
Yeah.
And and a vegetarian Benny. Like you need to have those three things.
Yeah. There probably needs to be an omelet, although I would say that's not as important as the two eggs any style or the Benedict.
I didn't include it on the list, but it's definitely a staple.
Yeah. I think less so in contemporary brunch culture, but like at a hotel, breakfast, buffet, you would need omelets.
Yeah.
But I think more critical than that, you have to get into the sweet pastry centric, breakfast. So pancakes, waffles, that's it. That's all of them. Pancakes and waffles.
You're missing the big one. You're missing the king, Alan, the king of brunch menus.
The king of brunch menus. Is it
king of sweet items on brunch menus?
It's not pancakes or waffles.
No.
Cake. Just kidding. I don't know.
Give it one more shot. I'm sure you'll get it.
A sweet brunch item that's not pancakes or waffles.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe you won't get it. Maybe you're just blanking on it. It's French toast. French toast is on every frickin' brunch menu.
Who orders that?
People order it, man. If you don't have it, you get harassed.
But like, do you know a human who would rather eat French toast than pancakes?
Yeah, probably.
You're friends with them?
Harsh. I don't know. I'm trying to think if my sister would rather have French toast than pancakes. Maybe not.
French toast over waffles. But yeah,
French toast is a big one.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean waffles. Maybe waffles are the king, but waffles are also a little more like, I feel like you don't wind up with waffles on as many brunch menus because it requires specific equipment.
Right.
That not every restaurant that just wants to serve brunch on the weekends to, like, you know, pack people in has, you know, the ability or space for.
Right.
So yeah, I feel like you wind up missing waffles more often than you wind up missing pancakes or French toast.
Right.
You almost got my whole list.
Mimosa.
Okay. Yep. You knocked another one off. There's one thing left on my list, but it's kind of not really fair. And it may be more, based on my, like, it might be recency bias connected to some traumas that I have, but, mm-hmm. but I do have one more thing on my list.
Okay. Bloody Mary.
It's avocado toast. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
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 Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a new addition to this pantheon, mm-hmm. But I feel like it's pretty up there mm-hmm. these days. avocado toast at a brunch restaurant. And then obviously, like, for brunch also, you need to provide some lunch-ish options. So there's usually some kind of like grilled cheese, some kind of like croque monsieur or something like that, and then some kind of burger usually. Mm-hmm. or something like that. But I wouldn't call them brunch staples in the way that Eggs Benedict is, like, a thing where people will freak out if you don't have it.
Right.
Yeah. So that's brunch. I don't know. Like, what's happening here? Like, why can't you have a brunch menu where you don't have Eggs Benedict?
Do you hate Eggs Benedict?
No, I love it.
Oh, okay.
It's just delicious, checking. And I like making it. I'm just, like, trying to understand why, you know, it, because I don't think that it's on every menu because people think it's delicious. Because I think that there are tons of foods that are delicious and that people love and that people are aware of that just aren't on every menu, you know? Like,
I think that a big part of it, especially for Benedict, you might find this hard to understand, Shil, because you're such a seasoned chef and you cook a lot at home, but a lot of the appeal of restaurant food is it's stuff that you probably would never make at home. So French fry, like anything deep fried, like most people, like, even though I don't think this is intelligent, most people don't like to deep fry at home because it's work, it's dirty, it's, maybe they think it's dangerous. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think there's a reasonable justification for that.
But I think that Eggs Benedict is a perfect example of something that is really delicious. People love, they'll almost never make it at home. And even, I know this is, again, like, try and step out of your chef mindset, but like even poaching eggs, I think people scramble eggs all the time. I don't think very many people poach eggs, even though it's probably easier to do than scrambling eggs.
Man, me too. I always scramble eggs. I never poach them.
Yeah, poaching eggs.
Unless I'm making Eggs Benedict.
Making hollandaise. I just don't think it's something that most people would want to do for themselves most weekends. But you can show up at a restaurant and they've got a thermos full of hollandaise. They've got...
got a siphon full of hollandaise, yeah, and exactly, like, yeah, mimosas on tap.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're just good to go.
So I think that's a big... And it's funny because the logistics behind that dish aren't actually that daunting in a professional kitchen, mm-hmm, but it's a world away from what most people would cook for themselves,
are willing to do at home.
Yeah,
that's a really good point. Yeah, and I don't think I was really thinking about that. Obviously, I sympathize with the idea that not everyone is comfortable doing all of the cooking tasks that I might be comfortable with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's, I mean, even for me, you know, like, I don't really want to, on my weekend day, you know, pull out four or five different cooking vessels and...
Right.
You know, like, it is. It's a way bigger. It's easy when you're in a restaurant and you have all the equipment in front of you. But to do it in your home kitchen, it requires a lot more time and commitment. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I definitely see that. So I guess, like, you know, what you're saying then, if we extrapolate from there, is that the reason why something like Eggs Benedict, or maybe even something like French toast, and probably something like waffles, and... I mean, maybe not so much so for Eggs Any Style, although it is a lot of different stuff that you have to make. Is that the reason why these things are so popular is because of customer demand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think... See, I guess, like, what I'm trying to figure out here is, like... Is that customer demand? It's sort of like what I said before. There are a ton of things that are delicious and that are more complicated for people to make at home than they might necessarily like, but that aren't on every brunch menu. So, is it customer demand, or is customer demand just like another way of rephrasing customer familiarity. Like, is the customer demand only there because customers are familiar with these things? And they're the thing, like, you know, like, I guess kind of maybe what we're talking about a little bit is comfort food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the things that people have had a lot and they, you know, and they know that they like that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the demand is there. Or is the demand there because those are the best possible brunch items that you can have? You know what I'm saying? Like, do you understand the difference that I'm trying to illustrate?
Yeah, I think so. But it's kind of like, it's, I'm not bothered, especially for brunch. Like, I'm not bothered by how narrow the like menu, needs to be, or how predictable the menu mm-hmm. needs to be, because it's like, it's just a little bit of dining culture. And we always like maybe accuse North Americans of not having like a food culture in the same way that,
mm-hmm.
Europe and Asia does, but like, it's nice. Here's this, like, this kind of, like you said, a pantheon of dishes, good word, that people crave and look forward to for a certain time of the week. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like, I don't find it distressing at all. Like, even if it is predictable, like, it's, people love it and you can make a killing. Well, I don't know if you can make a killing. You can do well serving it, if you make the food well, right, and serve it well. So yeah, I think it's nice. It's a little piece of, North American weekend dining culture.
Mm-hmm. I think it's nice too. Although,
what do you want on your brunch? What are all these, like, these dishes that you're talking or alluding to that are really wonderful to have on a Saturday morning at a restaurant, but aren't ever on a brunch menu? Like, are we talking about like dosas, or what are we talking about here? Because that's a breakfast food, isn't it? Isn't dosa a breakfast food?
In India? Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Well, I do have a couple of, I don't have the best examples for those things. I was honestly, before we got into the conversation, I was trying to come up with examples of exactly what we're talking about right now, because I do think that this is like an important distinction to make.
Mm.
But before we get there, I just want to like bring us back a little bit to previously in the conversation, because I think like the reason why, you know, like you're saying, like, you know, it's nice that we have this like piece of dining culture. But, you know, I guess the reason why maybe it's a topic for us as chefs has something to do with like the conversation that we had a little bit earlier about putting a green salad on the Ernest's menu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that like, as a chef, if you're designing a menu and you want to bring in some different experiences for people, or bring some creativity to the table, or you have your pet favorites and you want them to be on the menu and you have to sacrifice something else, it can feel a little bit like, I don't know what the right word is, like
you're shackled or you have to sell out or something, or.
Yeah. I don't know about selling out, but yeah, it can feel a little bit shackling to have all of these standards that you kind of have to have on the menu. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be made to feel like you're letting down your paying customers.
Right.
And I obviously, you know, fully understand that, you know, it really is important to meet your customers' expectations or exceed them. And, you know, and if they're expecting mimosas, then what's the harm of having mimosas?
Right.
You know, like it totally makes sense. But yeah, it can feel a little bit limiting, you know, as a creative professional, to have to adhere to this sort of like expectations of a certain type of menu mm-hmm. or whatever.
Mm-hmm. This is also something we've definitely talked about before, but it would have been ages ago. But I think it was, we had a conversation about menu writing ruts.
Yeah, yeah.
And I specifically remembered, I wasn't in charge of writing the menu, but talking to the chefs at Jack's Grill were especially, it felt like appetizers, they had a lot more freedom. But for entrees, it was like, okay, well, there's going to be six or seven entrees. One of them's going to be beef, probably tenderloin. One of them's going to be duck breast. One of them's going to be rack of lamb. One of them's going to be chicken. one of them's going to be vegetarian. And so like it was, very limiting in that sense. But then, even though it was, a restaurant that was in its decline, like that is what its loyal customers for decades expected. And so if you had a problem with it as a young creative chef, the answer was to leave,
exactly what I'm talking about. Like why, you know, like it, even in the case of like something like duck or like what, you know, why, like for that style of restaurant, I don't think it would like totally have been outside the like, realm of what would seem reasonable to customers to have like rabbit on the menu. But there probably never was rabbit on the menu.
Not for an entree.
Or maybe.
Not for an entree, I don't think, but.
Yeah. And so it's just like, I don't know. It's interesting. That's kind of like, to me, that's the interesting thing to talk about. Like, why on a brunch menu isn't Scotch eggs a big thing?
Right. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Like, they're amazing, right? Yeah. Like, you get this, like, beautifully soft-boiled egg, and it's, you know, like, it's such a perfect kind of brunch item, and it's delicious, and, you know, but it's just, it's never there. And in fact, I think that, like, people are kind of intimidated by the idea of Scotch eggs or something, but it could just be, like, are people intimidated by the idea of Scotch eggs in Scotland? I doubt it. You know, like,
is that where they're like from?
It's delicious.
I'm just kidding.
It's delicious food, and it would totally fit in. And you know, but it you just don't see it. You know, and but you could. But then, if you had Scotch eggs on your menu, but you didn't have avocado toast, well, you know, what would that be? Mm-hmm. You know. Would you get like, and then where does the pressure start to come in? You know, like, is it, you know, like you get customers who are saying to the servers that you, that they wish that you had a certain item, and then that causes, you know, uncomfortable conversations between servers and customers. And then, you know, and then you get this sort of like follow on effect of, you know, the servers expressing that, you know, it would be better if we had this item, and they didn't have to explain why we don't have it or something, or that people should try a Scotch egg instead of avocado toast or something like that. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of meat here. And I wonder if there's a way like to sort of like decipher, like, is it a rut or is it nice? Is it, you know, like, can I mean, like, I guess like the outlet is like, you can have a brunch menu with all of these things on it, and then if you want, you can also put on Scotch eggs. And if nobody ever orders them, well, then I guess you have your answer. You know?
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not trying to like act butthurt because you don't get to be creative as a chef. I'm just like trying to understand why, you know, like why we have these like standards in the way that they are. Okay, should we move on from brunch to like the casual fine dining list that I have here? This is going to be a lot more contentious, I feel like.
I bet. Yeah. Okay, so if I had to, like, even just thinking about the kind of template that I have in the back of my mind, like, there's going to be a soup, there's going to be a salad,
right?
Usually for casual fine dining, I would expect there to be a raw item. I wouldn't say that carpaccio is like something that people walk into the restaurant demanding, but like I would expect that there's a tuna crudo,
right? But when the tuna is on the menu at the casual fine dining restaurant, what is it called? I mean, like, maybe it's called poke or something like that,
right?
But I would say in like 80% of cases it's gonna be called tuna carpaccio.
Okay, well, I mean, if it's prepared as a carpaccio, like if it's
Yeah, well, which it usually is, because people are, because people know what carpaccio is.
Yeah, I don't know. And like, I think that tuna tartare.
Tartare is also like fairly. Yeah.
I would probably expect there to be a pasta.
Yeah, handmade pasta of some kind to have on my list. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the one, like, I don't know, like, I wouldn't walk in demanding something like this, but I always think about, like, there should be some kind of hot protein-centric appetizer, like something like pork belly or... Or confit or something like that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else on the appetizer side. That's what I got. Did I miss anything?
No, I mean, like, the things that I have are, like, a lot... are a lot more specific, I would say, and less sort of like general in terms of the, you know, in the way that you laid it out. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them sort of fit into those categories. So yeah, the stuff that I have on my list is like a carpaccio or I think it's fair to say some kind of raw dish. Mm-hmm. I have like either a filet mignon or a ribeye. Like one of those two things is probably going to be on the menu. And if it's not, you're probably going to get a lot of customer feedback about it.
See, I would, that was like the Jack's Grill kind of sense that I had, like that we're going to have a beef entree and it needs to be one of the top three. Like it needs to be rib, strip or filet. I think
it was probably 80% of the time. It was probably filet too. I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Spring Creek Ranch. I think that has changed quite a bit. Maybe. And again, this is maybe like a, almost generational conversation too, but I think that is not true anymore for modern, like contemporary small plate or like shared plate restaurants where people are much more interested. Sorry. People are increasingly interested in things like hanger steak and flat iron and, flank and stuff like that.
As much as I agree with what you're saying, I think it's much more common to have those items be like a feature. You know, I think the reason for that is supply. Like, you know, you can always get a filet, you know, you can always get a ribeye,
right?
Flank, you know, you can always get hanger, not so much. The supply isn't necessarily there. You can maybe get it for, you can get a couple weeks worth or something like that at a time. And then
I don't know, that's certainly true of like if you're buying straight from producers. I would be shocked if like a distributor couldn't provide you with things like skirt,
tons and tons of hanger
steak. Skirt and hanger. But but actually
I've had trouble getting skirt before reliably, but anyway.
And the biggest difference between like say my time at Jack's, during which I was largely feeding people who were older than my parents, and the shared plate places now, is that it used to be, it would be filet mignon as an entree, and it would be filet mignon with potato pave and seasonal vegetables and a reduction sauce and I don't know, like a Yorkshire pudding or something. But now it's, and that would cost, 15 years ago, that would cost $40 or something. And now it's, you can have a 16 ounce ribeye and it will come with butter, like compound butter. And maybe a reduction sauce, and that's it.
And it's
and it'll be $75 or something. So it's not, less likely to be a composed plate and more like just like, here's, you want red meat? Here's like a luscious piece of red meat that you're going to pay dearly for, which is fine. That's the kind of the economics now, but.
Yeah. I mean, if it's good, then yeah. And if that's what you want, then Caesar salad I have on here.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. Maybe it doesn't quite fit. I mean, it definitely fits in the pub thing, I think, but
it's not a like much more in a diner or a pub setting where people go expecting there to be a Caesar. But if you're going to a fine dining restaurant, like I don't think you'd be surprised to see a Caesar, but I don't think you'd be upset if it weren't there.
I'll copy and paste it out of here.
Okay,
right
good.
Now.
Yeah, get rid of it.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry for saying that one. Some kind of salmon dish. Well, some kind of fish dish, but I would say like in 80% of cases, it's going to be a piece of salmon. I guess like things like that are similar to salmon, like char and trout too, mm-hmm. but, and it's usually glazed, some kind of glazed preparation mm-hmm. of some kind of salmon-like fish. Usually, I don't know, maybe this isn't as common now, but usually some kind of surf and turf thing.
Okay.
And then the last thing that I have is duck fat French fries, which is
triple
just like
cooked duck fat French fries.
Standing in for, yeah, exactly. It's just standing in for like fancy French fries, right. French fries that are cooked in probably some kind of like animal fat or something that you wouldn't normally fill a whole deep fryer full of.
Right.
And then, yeah, like they're super special French fries that then have like, I don't know, Parmesan and truffle grated over top of them or something.
Truffle oil is coming to mind here.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah.
That's basically everything that I have for the casual fine dining. But I feel like, honestly, I feel like we've gotten I do think that it has gotten a lot better than it used to be, where it, in terms of the differentiation of creativity for casual fine dining restaurants. But I do think that there is like sort of a level of this type of restaurant that kind of adheres to this type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like there's always going to be a beef, and there's usually going to be some kind of poultry dish, and there's probably going to be a fish dish, and mm-hmm. you know, it's constructed that way. Yep. And yeah, the pappardelle thing. It's probably pappardelle on this menu.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, maybe casual fine dining isn't the right way to approach this. I don't know. It was like sort of, when I was doing this prep, this idea of like this kind of casual fine dining sort of stereotypical casual fine dining menu was like kind of in my head. But yeah, maybe we have sort of moved on from that. Maybe a lot of the more like casual fine dining restaurants are a lot more regional now than they used to be, and so they tend to have dishes that are like more authentically regional. I think there's a lot of that type of restaurant that has moved on to trying to do something that's like, you know, an authentic version of food that people are familiar with or something like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're kind of out of that era. And then we have pub.
Mm-hmm.
What are the pub foods you can name, Alan?
Fish and chips.
Yep.
Burgers.
Obviously.
Beef dip.
I was debating putting it on here. I think that's totally fair to add. Like just about every pub menu has a beef dip.
And do we need to clarify that we're talking about North American pubs?
Yeah,
like we're not talking about
traditional. Yeah, we're
English
not talking
pubs,
about right? English pubs.
Okay, well that makes it a little bit easier for me. Chicken wings, nachos,
yeah.
Maybe some kind of popper.
I have matzo sticks, but
okay,
yeah, okay.
Yeah. Probably a pizza, which is silly, but.
I didn't put it on here, but yeah, I think you're right.
And then, yeah, sandwiches. It's like burgers, chicken burger, beef dip. I don't know.
Some kind of grilled cheese thing.
Yeah. I don't think it's as, it's not in the same boat as something like fish and chips and burgers, but like steak sandwich maybe.
Yeah. I didn't put it on here. I don't know if it's as much of a staple as it used to be, but. Mm-hmm.
That's what I got. What am I missing?
The only thing that I have that you didn't say was poutine,
right.
Which,
yeah,
you know, like the French fries are there. Like you could just say French fries and in various, you know, like French fry variations,
right.
You could say, but yeah, man, chicken wings and nachos like those.
Yeah.
Like, man, what happened with chicken wings? Like, what happened there? How did that happen?
Tell me.
It's so amazing.
Can you extrapolate? I mean, can you elaborate?
Well, just like, I mean, at some point, chicken wings were cheap, and that's why they got put on pub menus. Mm-hmm. because nobody wanted to use them. They were like a throwaway part of the chicken. And then somebody realized that they were cheap and figured out a genius way to market them as like finger food. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming someone in Buffalo. I don't know.
Buffalo, New York?
Yeah, Buffalo, New York. That's where buffalo wings come from, right? Frank's Red Hot and all that.
I'll take your word for it.
Okay. And yeah, and now they're on every menu. I think they grow chickens now that are just like 80% wing.
Right.
It's crazy. And when you try to buy chicken wings in the grocery store, they're one of the most expensive parts of the chicken now.
Is that right?
Yeah, they're pricey. Hmm. Like, they're like maybe not twice as expensive, but like they're a lot more expensive than drumsticks. Like, they're probably almost twice as expensive as drumsticks. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be shocked. Is that a piece of follow-up for the next episode?
Per kilo, you mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, yeah, well, how come we don't eat chicken drumsticks at the pub?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the only pub menu that I ever actually wrote had drumsticks on it instead of wings.
Denizen?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, the Denizen Hall, we serve chicken drums instead of chicken wings.
Makes sense.
Yeah, because they're less expensive and...
better yield, probably. Oh, I don't know, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like...
like, you're not going to... No one's...
they're less expensive. There's more meat on it. Like, you can give people more of a bigger portion for less, and... yeah.
And no one just eats two or three chicken wings. They eat a dozen. And so why don't you just eat two drumsticks instead?
Yeah, or three, or... or 2 pounds, or I don't know, like whatever
you feel. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I like chicken wings, though.
So do I. And I like to be able to get them when I go to a pub. And I like it when I go to a pub and I get chicken wings and they're like really good. Mm-hmm. Then I'm like, oh, wow, this is amazing.
Yep.
So weird.
And nachos, do you know my nacho trick? Like, this is kind of like the McDonald's trick where you, if you're not sure the fries will be fresh, you ask for fries with no salt. You know that one, right? We've talked about that before, I think.
Yeah, I know that one. I'm an ex-McDonald's employee. I know. Of course I know.
For years and years, every Tuesday night I threw darts at Avenue Pizza.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I would get pizza, but usually I would get nachos. And I would... much to the annoyance of the server and the...
you would ask for nachos without salt.
Well, I would get a half order of nachos. I would always get a half order. Yeah. And then when I was almost done my half order of nachos, almost done eating it, I would order another half order.
Whoa. So, isn't that more expensive than just ordering one whole order?
No, it wasn't. But it made sure that I wasn't eating cold congealed cheese.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was always fresh.
That's great that they, I'll bet also, like, there's probably a little more on a half order than half. I don't know. Like, maybe, I don't know how they measure it, but that's a good hack. Good life hack, Alan. You should have a TikTok channel.
What the hell is that? Just kidding.
You did real good on pub. And I don't think we really missed anything. Unless you start talking about, like, English pub food or something like that. But I don't think we missed anything that's, like, a pub standard. Should we move on to dessert?
Sure.
Okay.
Everything has to be decadent, Shale. Make sure it's luxuriously decadent. And there's going to be some... one of them's going to be chocolate. One of them's going to be fruit.
Yeah.
And one of them... no, that's it.
There has to be a chocolate and there has to be a fruit.
Yeah.
You're right.
And then...
can you be more specific than that, though?
The chocolate one needs to be decadent. It needs to be so, like, lasciviously decadent. But I don't know. But beyond that, like, I've never had to write a dessert menu, but I would imagine that you want one that's kind of like... one bit that's, like, pastry-based, like cake or pastry... one piece that's like maybe, well, gluten-free, I guess. So like a custard, like a set custard. There has to be, yeah. It depends on the venue, obviously, but like creme brulee, casual fine dining, there has to be a creme brulee, right? Or a posset.
Creme brulee, yeah. Posset. See, that's something that you could have on a dessert menu that would be something that isn't on every freaking dessert menu everywhere and that, you know, would be an interesting thing for people to try and they'd probably really love it, but you never find it anywhere. Mm-hmm. That's like a great example of that.
Mm-hmm. And even I think that like stirred custard, like pudding should be on more menus. Cause I like creme brulee as much as anybody, but like if you serve me butterscotch pudding, like would probably lose my mind in a good way. I mean,
that butterscotch pudding at Tenfoot Henry. Have you had that?
No, but I remember you. I remember you saying,
"Let's go to Calgary."
Okay, sure. But no, I do remember you mentioning that, and it had some kind of sponge toffee or something on it, right? For texture.
Yeah, they top it with sponge toffee. It's really good.
But even like, it could be trifle if you want to get really fancy and put layers on it. It could be trifle like stirred custard and Jello.
Never
and
see
cake.
Trifle.
No, I think it probably is perceived as like a lazy dessert. It's like leftovers and pre-made and stuff, but
yeah, maybe we're getting into a little bit of like what can't I make for myself at home,
right,
with this dessert menu situation. Yeah,
but even just like,
although that probably applies to just about every dessert, but aside from like birthday cake and pie or something, right. I don't know.
What else for dessert? So a standard dessert menu, I'm picturing fruit in pastry, some kind of luxurious chocolate thing, a creme brulee, and then what? Lemon tart.
Yeah, I really went back and forth about putting lemon tart on here because I do think that it fits. You're real close on a lot of the stuff that I have here, but the only thing that you really called out by name is creme brulee, and there's one that I'm pretty shocked that you didn't get, actually, but
I didn't get.
Anyway, we'll get there. Okay, so chocolate, yes, obviously every dessert menu has some kind of chocolate thing on it. And yeah, you're right, it's got to be lasciviously decadent, as you put it. I would say the number one chocolate decadent representation on dessert menus across the board is a brownie. Something with a brownie, something brownie that's covered in something, brownie with ice cream, brownie with decadent chocolate sauce, whatever.
Right.
Some kind of brownie.
Okay.
And then chocolate lava cake is like the other one. Mm-hmm. And then also some kind of like chocolate torte, I would say, like, you know, like a kind of chocolate cake that's basically made with no flour.
Oh, okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's the chocolate group. Chocolate torte, chocolate lava cake, or brownie something. Then you've got cheesecake.
Right, okay.
This, in a lot of cases, is where your fruit
situation
is going to come into play. Yep. Some kind of fruit cheesecake. Cheesecake is like bog standard dessert menu fodder.
Mile High New York cheesecake.
Yeah, right? Exactly. With raspberry sauce. Then we've got tiramisu.
Okay. Yeah.
It's on every dessert menu. Bring me a globe and I'll spin it and I'll put my finger on the globe and I'll bet there's a restaurant at the spot that I pick that has tiramisu on their menu.
Do you see it a lot on not Italian restaurant menus?
Yes. Like every, yeah.
Okay.
It's on like tons of chain restaurant menus. Right. It's on tons of like regular, like sort of like North American style restaurants that serve brunch. Often they have a tiramisu on the menu. It's probably a play on tiramisu something. It's like a, I don't know, like a matcha tiramisu or a pumpkin tiramisu or something. Well, thanks. You can use that one out.
Well, tiramisu with tea. I think that's a good idea. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Instead of coffee. Yeah. Although I think matcha tiramisu is like pretty popular already, but And then creme brulee, like you said, very popular on dessert menus. And then the one that I'm shocked that you didn't get is some kind of like bread pudding-ish kind of thing. Bread pudding, sticky toffee pudding, something like that.
Is there really a lot of bread pudding on menus right now, Shale? I know that we've talked
maybe
about
not as much as there used to be. And we're in the vortex for bread pudding on dessert menus. So, you know, like it may not be fair for me to bring it up, but I feel like it's an Edmonton thing.
Right.
So, yeah.
I'm going to do some research. And maybe you can too. If you can find 5 restaurants in Edmonton that serve bread pudding right now,
you'll capitulate.
Yeah, exactly. I know it's like a running joke with us, like that people love it. People of a certain age love it. And we've talked about it.
Alan, I'm practically of that age.
Well, not when we started this conversation, but.
No, that's true.
But yeah, I'm sure it's probably still on the Glass Monkeys menu.
Yeah.
But like where else? I don't know where else I've seen bread pudding. Sticky toffee pudding to me is a different, like I know they're both called pudding, but to me it's not the same dish and not the same.
You're right. It isn't the same, but I think it's fairly similar. Like, yeah, it is different. You're right. But I think they fill the same spot, I guess is what I was trying to say on the dessert menu. Right. It's like that kind of
simple starch cake, just doused in
exactly.
Sugar
that,
sauce.
That tends to have a ton of like caramel sauce on it or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's dessert menus. I don't think we got to the bottom of anything here. I don't know. It's interesting to me that we have these like, is this how you go about identifying North American food culture? Is just like finding things that seem stereotypical to put on menus? I don't know. It's weird. I don't mean to minimize what you were saying about like the expectation of being able to like go for brunch and you have all these things that, you know, like we, you know, like that we can expect and like to have on the weekend that we don't have to cook at home for ourselves. Like I think that's totally valid, but yeah, I don't know. I do think that there's another side of it where there are just like tons of things that could be the same, you know, have the same level of popularity, but they just don't for whatever reason. And people, I think because of the things that are so popular, are afraid to put them on menus. Mm. And therefore they don't really have a chance to have their like day in the sun or something like that. Mm. Like why aren't butter tarts on more Canadian menus? Right? Like it's like a Canadian thing and it's delicious and it's pretty easy to make and people love them. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. You would think you would see more butter tarts on menus.
Yeah.
Or like, I don't know.
Like Nanaimo bars.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you do wind up seeing that quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, more in cafes, I guess. Right. But yeah. Yeah.
I do think that at the end of the day, like you can be an all-star creative and make menus that, you know, no one even knows how to read, but there's way more like it's not a bad thing, but you are much more restricted in what you can produce for an actual viable commercial operation based on this kind of dialogue with you and your customers and your service team, where it's like,
yeah,
there's a, you can market yourself in a way where it's like, yeah, we're doing this crazy stuff that you've never heard of, come and try it out. But that's a whole different gambit than like,
yeah,
I'm making the food that you already know and want to eat. Like,
yeah. Like that's a tricky way to market something. Like you're marketing to a very niche clientele of people who are a little bit more adventurous than maybe the average diner would be. And so, you know, you're already limiting the number of people that are going to be excited about coming to your place. Mm. And so I think then it's like, if you have pet dishes or things that you really love that you wish were more popular than they are, then yeah, you can slip them in between, you know, all of these things that people expect to be able to order. Mm. The problem is then once people are there and they have, and they're confronted with all of these things that like they know and love, what's the motivation for them to pick something that they haven't tried before?
Right.
And I guess like you just have to hope that maybe in the group of diners, there's like, if there's four people, there's three people who really are looking for the standards, and there's maybe one person who's looking to try something new. And then maybe they share it with their diner, with their dining cohort, and then everybody's like, oh, that's actually really good, I would order that next time, or something. I don't know.
It was a give and take, because it's I'm thinking of the scene in Big Night where they're the New Jersey clientele don't actually know risotto. They're not familiar with risotto. And the savvy business brother is like, well, maybe we should take risotto off the menu because people don't really understand it and it's expensive for us to produce. And then the chef brother says, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. Let's just put a hot dog on the menu, basically is the gist of it, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky balance, Jill.
It is a tricky balance, but made for good conversation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know, maybe next time one of us is making a brunch menu, we'll put scotch eggs on there.
Well, you remember that I'm putting scotch eggs on my lunch menu.
I remember. Good.
Yeah.
Good job, Alan. Way to sneak it in there.
But yeah, breakfast sausage wrapping on a soft egg and just like a nice salad.
Yeah, man. Amazing. What was the name of that restaurant in San Francisco that basically most of what they served was scotch eggs? What was that place called?
I don't know if this... Are you talking about Craftsman and Wolves that had the soft egg in the muffin, right? Like in a savory...
Oh, it was in a muffin. That's right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So if I remember right, it was like a savory, maybe cornmeal.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Or like kind of like a popover maybe or something. But yeah,
it was definitely
they were really good.
Yeah, it was definitely it was a muffin.
Like a, yeah.
Yeah. Soft egg inside, and they served it with, I don't even know if they're still open or what, but, and they served it with a vial of, they gave you a little vial of coarse salt to sprinkle
salt
into the yolk. Yeah.
Into the egg once you got there. Yeah, man.
Yeah, that was good.
Those were really good. Mm-hmm. Craftsman and Wolves.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.